2 Samuel chapter 18. We're going to attempt to cover the entire chapter. It's medium length, about 33 verses. I want to read through that, and then we'll focus in on the main theme of the chapter, cover most of the highlights at least. 2 Samuel 18. Then David mustered the men who were with him and set over them commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds. And David sent out the army, one-third under the command of Joab, one-third under the command of Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, Joab's brother, and one-third under the command of Ittai the Gittite. And the king said to the man, I myself will also go out with you. But the men said, you shall not go out, for if we flee, they will not care about us. If half of us die, they will not care about us. But you are worth 10,000 of us. Therefore, it is better that you send us help from the city. The king said to them, whatever seems best to you, I will do. So the king stood at the side of the gate while all the army marched out by hundreds and by thousands. The king ordered Joab and Abishai and Ittai, deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom. And all the people heard when the king gave orders to all the commanders about Absalom. So the army went out into the field against Israel. The battle was fought in the forest of Ephraim. And the men of Israel were defeated there by the servants of David, and the loss there was great on that day, 20,000 men. The battle spread over the face of all the country. And the forest devoured more people that day than the sword. And Absalom happened to meet the servants of David. Absalom was riding on his mule, and the mule went under the thick branches of a great oak, and his head caught fast in the oak, and he was suspended between heaven and earth, while the mule that was under him went on. And a certain man saw it and told Joab, behold, I saw Absalom hanging in an oak. Joab said to the man who told him, what? You saw him? Why then did you not strike him there to the ground? I would have been glad to give you 10 pieces of silver and a belt. But the man said to Joab, even if I felt in my hand the weight of 1,000 pieces of silver, I would not reach out my hand against the king's son. For in our hearing, the king commanded you and Abishai and Ittai, for my sake, protect the young man Absalom. On the other hand, if I had dealt treacherously against his life, and there is nothing hidden from the king, then you yourself would have stood aloof. Joab said, I will not waste time like this with you. He took 3 javelins in his hand and thrust them into the heart of Absalom while he was still alive in the oak. And 10 young men, Joab's armor bearers, surrounded Absalom and struck him and killed him. Then Joab blew the trumpet, and the troops came back from pursuing Israel, for Joab restrained them. And they took Absalom and threw him into a great pit in the forest and raised over him a very great heap of stones. And all Israel fled, everyone to his own home. Now Absalom in his lifetime had taken and set up for himself the pillar that is in the king's valley. For he said, I have no son to keep my name in remembrance. He called the pillar after his own name, and it is called Absalom's monument to this day. When Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, said, let me run and carry news to the king that the Lord has delivered him from the hand of his enemies. And Joab said to him, you are not to carry news today. You may carry news another day, but today you shall carry no news because the king's son is dead. Then Joab said to the Cushite, go, tell the king what you've seen. The Cushite bowed before Joab and ran. Then Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, said again to Joab, come what may, let me also run after the Cushite. And Joab said, why will you run, my son, seeing that you will have no reward for the news? Come what may, he said, I will run. So he said to him, run. Then Ahimaaz ran by the way of the plain and outran the Cushite. Now David was sitting between the 2 gates, and the watchman went up to the roof of the gate by the wall. When he lifted up his eyes and looked, he saw a man running alone. The watchman called out and told the king. And the king said, if he is alone, there is news in his mouth. And he drew nearer and nearer. The watchman saw another man running. The watchman called to the gate and said, "See, another man running alone." The king said, "He also brings news." The watchman said, "I think the running of the first is like the running of Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok." The king said, "He is a good man and comes with good news." Then Ahimaaz cried out to the king, "All is well." And he bowed before the king with his face to the earth and said, "Blessed be the Lord your God, who has delivered up the men who raised their hand against my lord the king." And the king said, "Is it well with the young man Absalom?" Ahimaaz answered, "When Joab sent the king's servant, your servant, I saw a great commotion, but I do not know what it was." And the king said, "Turn aside and stand here." So he turned aside and stood still. And behold, the Cushite came, and the Cushite said, "Good news for my lord the king, for the Lord has delivered you this day from the hand of all who rose up against you." The king said to the Cushite, "Is it well with the young man Absalom?" And the Cushite answered, "May the enemies of my lord the king and all who rise up against you for evil be like that young man." And the king was deeply moved and went up to the chamber over the gate and wept. And as he went, he said, "O my son Absalom, my son Absalom, would I had died instead of you, O Absalom, my son, my son." All right, this story brings to a conclusion a long episode in David's life. There's going to be in chapter 19 some after the battle important interactions between David and Joab and David and his men, David and the kingdom. But really, this is the culmination point of this episode. The episode, of course, started some time back in David's past from this point. It wasn't just the day before this or shortly before this that led to this culmination point. It really started back on that fateful day when, as a younger man, as a younger king, David had had sent his army out to battle. And instead of leading his army out to battle, had remained behind and remained behind in the city of Jerusalem in safety and comfort and security while his troops fought on his behalf. And that day when he saw the beautiful Bathsheba from the roof of the palace and called for her and committed adultery with her and then compounded his sin of adultery by arranging for the murder of her husband to cover his own tracks. Those sins, those two serious sins, really changed the course of David's life. We know, and we've studied through what happened after that, David spending a time of several months, not in a good place with the Lord at all, disconnected and drifting from the Lord. And then the Lord mercifully and graciously, though David did not deserve it, finally sending the prophet Nathan to him to confront him in his sin. And David does finally, in the direct confrontation by the prophet, David accepts the rebuke of the Lord through the prophet's mouth, and he repents, and he seeks the Lord's forgiveness and the Lord's mercy, and the Lord does forgive him, and the Lord does show mercy to him, and the Lord does restore him. But remember, our running theme now for several chapters has been that the Lord, after forgiving him and after restoring him, after showing mercy to him, the Lord proclaimed that there would be long-term consequences, short-term consequences, immediate consequences, but ongoing and long-term consequences, the most serious of which was the Lord had said to David in that process of restoration that the sword will never depart from your house, meaning that the sword representing the Lord's judgment, the Lord's serious accountability to David would, in a sense, hang over his household and his family from that point forward. And, of course, this story is the story of this sword consequence playing out in David's family in probably the most cutting way to date since the sin with Bathsheba and her husband Uriah. And that's because Absalom is, of course, David's son, but he's his most dearly beloved son. He's what we could call, the scripture doesn't use this description, but I think it's a valid description. He's like the apple of David's eye. He's He's David's most cherished son in his family. But there's been problems with David and Absalom. We've seen what those problems are. It goes back to the sad, really tragic story of another son of David's crossing a very serious moral line and taking advantage of his own sister, who happened to be his half-sister and the full sister of Absalom, taking advantage of her, raping her, and then Absalom being enraged both by the act of his half-brother and David's failure to take control of that circumstance and hold that son accountable and to enact justice toward him. When David refused to do that, when David failed to do that, Absalom was motivated to take justice into his own hands, and he arranged for the murder of his half-brother. And in doing that, he set in motion a sequence of events in which he was estranged from his father, lived for a couple of years outside of the city in exile, self-imposed exile, and completely disconnected from his father. And then he was brought back through the agency of Joab. We see Joab having a key part in this story here, but remember, it was Joab who convinced David to bring Absalom back into the city and back into his good graces. And we studied this one time. I want you to remember this important detail, that when Absalom came back to the city, David accepted him to come back to the city, but continued to remain distant from him. And it required a sequence of events that led to finally David embracing Absalom. But in doing so, he failed to hold Absalom accountable, just like he had failed to hold his other son accountable. And so he embraced him, he welcomed him back, and didn't require anything of Absalom, though Absalom was guilty of murder. And that sets up this whole circumstance in which Absalom, in his bitterness toward his father, has concocted this plan, this conspiracy, to rebel against his father and to steal the kingdom from David. So in this circumstance, what has happened, of course, is that Absalom has driven David out of the city of Jerusalem. We've spent the last several studies studying how David left the city and the progression of events as he traveled out of the city and walked up the slopes of the Mount of Olives, and the interesting series of providential connections, encounters that David had with key individuals as he was fleeing the city. Remember, we saw that he fled into the wilderness, and he is really, David is mirroring in the opposite way the progression of how the Lord had brought the children of Israel into the promised land from the wilderness. Now David, under the consequences of the Lord, is being driven out of the capital city of Jerusalem, out of the city of the Lord, out of the promised land, and being driven back into the wilderness because of his sin, because of his stubbornness, and because of his disobediences to the Lord. And in that, Absalom has moved into the city of Jerusalem. At the beginning as this chapter opens, he's moved into the city of Jerusalem, and he's become the king. He's made himself king over Israel. And Absalom has the majority of people with him. David has an army, and as we see, he still has an effective group following him, and they certainly are very effective in their battle here in chapter 18. But the larger army is with Absalom, and the majority of the kingdom has chosen to follow him. So that's our background. And then this chapter opens with the circumstance of the inevitable battle. What we have here is a civil war. It's an interesting civil war. It's the contrast between this civil war in Israel and our experience as a nation in our civil wars is pretty significant. How long, does anybody remember, and I don't want to turn this into a history lesson, but how long did our civil war last here in this country back in the 1800s? 4 years. This civil war lasts how long? One day. One single day. And instead of a series of devastating battles, there's one single devastating battle. In the ancient world, for 20,000 men to die in battle in a single day was a tremendous thing. I mean, it really was a significant and devastating thing. But we see the mercy of the Lord in that while civil war is necessary and it's inevitable, nevertheless, it's a mercy of the Lord that this doesn't stretch on for 4 years or longer, and that there's a sequence of battles. A single day, the Lord, in a sense, constrains or sets boundaries around how bad this is going to be. But what we're meant to understand, what we're meant to see from this story, before we look at the details of how it unfolds, is that all of this, this battle of this day, this civil war, this problem between David and Absalom, and what results in the death of 20,000 men, is happening for one reason and one reason only. It's happening because that day, on the roof of the palace, when David should have been leading his army out into battle, he chose to stay behind in comfort and cross the line of righteousness into sin and sin against the Lord. The only reason these 20,000 men lose their lives that day is because David had sinned. Had he not sinned that day, the implication of the story is that the nation would have remained unified and there never would have been this civil war that occurred. So we're meant to look at this and see the devastating fallout, the big picture consequences of one leader's sin. And I'm thinking in terms of the parallel between this, for instance, and the story we all are so familiar with that opens the entire Bible, the story of history itself, in the story of Adam. One man in a garden committing a single act where he crosses a line that the Lord clearly lays out for him that he never should have crossed, had no business crossing. But once he crosses that line, he sets into motion, though he himself was mercifully forgiven for that sin, nevertheless, he sets in motion consequences that he can't control where those consequences go. He can't stop what is going to happen once he crosses that line. And you and I are still living out to this day the consequences of Adam crossing that line at the beginning of human history, because we live in a fallen world. We live in fallen human physical bodies. You know, you and I die at the end of our lives because Adam sinned. And that's a long-term, long-range consequence that will never change until the Lord returns and starts an entire new creation in this world. And so the same thing is going on here. David representing the Lord himself. He is the representation symbolically of Adam, of the head of God's new creation symbolically in Israel. He has committed a sin, and in committing that sin, he sets in motion consequences that affect everybody around him, in fact, affect the entire nation. But in terms of the chapter here, we have the story of the battle, and we have the story, of course, of the death of David's dearly beloved son, Absalom. It starts in the first few verses, the first five verses, with David mustering his army. What we mean by that is simply, he knows that a fight is unavoidable, it's inevitable, and so he wisely organizes his army. He does so by organizing the army into divisions and then establishing commanders over each division. Two of the commanders we should expect. The third one is somewhat unusual and surprising, but we encountered him in the special series of providential encounters as David was leaving the city. The third commander is Ittai the Gittite. What's unusual about Ittai being established by David as one of the commanders is, remember, Ittai was among the Philistines. Ittai, you know, was actually the leader of a group of special Philistine soldiers that David had made this connection with during his earlier adventures when he had gone to the Philistine territory to flee from the hand of Saul when Saul was king. And Ittai had remained loyal to David during all this time. And the the depth and the extent of Ittai's loyalty is really portrayed in that on this most critical day, David entrusts a third of his army, the leadership of his army, under the leadership of Ittai the Gittite. As David is arranging and organizing his army, he proclaims or declares that he has every intention of going out to battle with them. And, of course, his men then immediately appeal to him. In fact, it's even portrayed as a little stronger than an appeal. They demand that David remains behind in the city, and they lay out a good case for why he should remain behind, and that they see that his value in terms of the entire army is greater than, it's the equal to 10, he's worth 10,000 of them in the army. And they ask him to remain behind so that he would be in a position of kind of commanding the entire battle. He would be able to send out help and be able to send out reinforcements from the city. And David wisely recognizes that their appeal has merit, and he accepts their appeal, and he does remain behind. And I want us to understand that what we're dealing with here are spiritual principles and not spiritual formulas, in that we're contrasting the events of this day, which is kind of the end of a story, with how that story began. The story began, I've referenced a couple of times, with that day years before that was also a day for battle, when the passage actually says this is the time when kings go out to battle and they lead their armies into battle. And David had remained behind in the city and ended up sinning with Bathsheba. This day, instead of wanting to remain behind like he did in that earlier day, this day he wanted to go out, but his army appealed to him and requested of him to remain behind, and he does remain behind. What's the difference between remaining behind now and remaining behind then? It's not about the choice that's made. It's about the principles that are involved in that choice. The first time he chose out of a desire for comfort, out of a desire for safety and protection, out of a desire to just let others fight his battles for him. His heart was not in a good place on that earlier day. Now, his heart has been trained by the experiences that he's had since then. And his heart's in a better place. He's grown from the experience. He's learned from the experience. And even though now he's really too old to lead his army out into battle in the same way that he did before, his heart is there. He wants to lead his army into battle, and only chooses to remain behind when his troops wisely appeal to him to do so. If we were following a spiritual formula, we would say in every case the king should remain behind, or in every case the king should go out and lead his troops to battle. But what we're dealing with is what is the wise principle to apply in each and every circumstance. And the principle would teach us that in the earlier circumstance, as a younger king, David should have led his troops to battle, and in this circumstance, it was wise for him to remain behind. And so the principle is something that we need to pay attention to and not kind of reduce, as our natural tendency is, reduce our spiritual choices to formulas that we don't have to think through and consider all of the factors that are involved in the decisions that we make. So David's remained behind in the city. We see that as the troops leave the city, he stood by the side of the gate. This is a small detail. We can easily read past it. I think it's significant, though. It tells us something that even though David was remaining behind in the city, his heart was with his troops. He didn't stay in, you know, he wasn't like sleeping late in you know, a comfortable house. He got up as the troops were going out to battle. He stood by the gate. He kind of encouraged their hearts, no doubt, by his presence as they went out to battle, showing that while he wasn't physically with them, his heart was fully with them as they went out to fight on his behalf. Now, does that mean, though, and I'm describing that David's in a better place this day than he was on that earlier day, does that mean that David's learned all the lessons that he should have learned from the Lord by this point, that he's in a 100% great place with the Lord? The answer is no. There's still lessons for David to learn. And I can just speak from personal experience. I know if you consider your own story from a wise and discerning perspective, you can identify with this as well. As much as we grow in our relationship with the Lord, however much progress we've made from the day we first started to walk with the Lord until our present day, there's always more to learn. There's always more to grow. There's always aspects of our character that need to be shaped and molded and refined to be made more like Christ. There's always some flaw in our character that needs the Lord's attention. And even though David's in a better place, and I believe, generally speaking, in a good place with the Lord now, he's not in any serious and overt and obvious sin, there's a problem this day as he sends his troops out into battle. And the problem is, it's even if he's remaining behind, it's important for him to give the right kind of commands and the right kind of orders as the general leading all of his troops out into battle. And David does give an order this day, but he gives the wrong order, and he gives an order that actually is going to, if it were to be followed to the letter, would actually hamstring his army as he sends them out into a battle. The orders we find in, of course, in verse 5. And the king ordered Joab and Abishai and Ittai. And who are they? The three commanders of his army. He orders them, deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom. Now, what do you get from the words deal gently? Do not kill him. Don't abuse him. Don't do anything to harm him. I want you to treat him with kid gloves. Now, what's the problem here? He's sending them out into war. This is what, you know, in modern terms, when we send armies out into battle, we call this now terms of engagement. There's boundary lines. Not just in the old days, and these were the old days, when you went out to war, the orders were generally this. Go out and kill the bad guys and defeat them by any means necessary. Do what you need to do to win the battle and to survive at the end of the battle. Terms of engagement are, well, here are the rules. And yes, we want you to win the battle, but we want you to be careful not to cross these particular lines. And they limit what an army can and can't do. So David gives a very strong and very specific term of engagement. I want you to go out and I want you to win the battle. But whatever you do, treat my son with kid gloves. Now, yes, Absalom is David's son. Yes, David loves him most dearly. But who really is Absalom at this moment? He is the rebellious king who has stolen the kingdom from his father. And as we see the story unfold, more than that, he's under the judgment of the Lord. And the Lord has purposed and planned for Absalom to meet a bitter end this day. And so what we see happening, and we're not meant to miss this important detail of the story. David is issuing orders that are actually contrasted with and contradicting the Lord's orders for Absalom. We don't hear the Lord speak from heaven. And certainly the Lord doesn't send a prophet this day to make sure everyone knows what his orders are. But we see the Lord's orders played out in the way the circumstance develops. We see the sovereignty of God at work in how the battle unfolds. Both, of course, in the fact that David's army defeats a far superior force of Absalom's army. But also we see the specific and direct sovereignty of God at work in the circumstance of what happens to Absalom. And yet David had issued orders without consideration on this very critical development in the history of Israel, without consideration of what the Lord's will was in this situation. Now we've seen David succeed gloriously and fail miserably in this one important detail. There are times critical moments in David's life when just before he does a new thing, he will stop, he will pray, he will cry out to the Lord, he will seek the Lord. Lord, what is your will in this situation? And then there are other times when he fails miserably to fail to even consider the Lord before he just goes and acts. And in this situation, which does David do? Do we see any hint that before he sends the troops to battle, he stops, seeks the Lord, prays, and says, Lord, you know I love my son Absalom, but I understand that he is a rebel, and what is your will for my son today? What do you want to have happen to my son? Because I'm going to have to give instructions and orders to the generals of my army, and I want my instructions to them to reflect your purpose for my son and for this kingdom. So what would you have me to say? That's how David should have approached the battle and his instructions, his orders to his army. But instead, without consideration of the Lord's will, he just orders them, in this case, misusing his authority, commanding them to do something contrary to the Lord's will and purpose. And it's a hint to us that with all that David's learned, with all that he's grown, there's still this core of self-absorption, self-focus, concern about his stuff, concern about his desires, concern about what he wants, placing that above the Lord's plan, the Lord's purpose, and the Lord's will for his kingdom. Because really, the kingdom of Israel is not David's kingdom. It was given to him. He was placed in charge of it. But David is king, and this is true for all the kings of Israel. It's true for any position of authority that any of us hold today. And that is, we're stewards. We're given responsibility over spheres of authority. But we serve in those spheres of authority for the Lord's purpose, not for our own. It's not for our own selfish desires and will and plans and purposes. This is what I want to have happen in my life. And so I'm just going to order the people under me to do what I want to have happen. And, you know, the Lord's going to just have to intervene and do the opposite if he wants something else done, rather than stopping, considering, seeking the Lord, and having his expression to perfectly mirror what the Lord's plan and purpose was. And so the army goes out with those orders, terms of engagement. And we even see, as the story plays out, as Absalom is discovered by some of David's soldiers, and he's riding his mule through the forest. Oh, before we get to that, there's an interesting comment I should at least mention. Reading from verse 8. Well, verse 7 tells us about the 20,000 men who lost their lives that day, but verse 8 kind of gives us a brief explanation of how that unfolded. The battle spread over the face of all the country, and the forest, this is the forest of Ephraim, the forest devoured more people that day than the sword. Well, we're talking about the sword being simply one soldier killing another soldier. And so out of 20,000, we don't know exact numbers, but something less than 10,000 of the 20,000 men that died were actually killed in sword-to-sword battle. That tells us more than 20,000 men were killed, but not by David's soldiers. More than 20,000 of the army of Absalom, I mean more than 10,000 of the army of Absalom lost their lives that day by some other means than the sword. And it's a very interesting description. We're not given any details of exactly how this happened, but it reminded me somewhat of one of the scenes from like the Lord of the Rings story, where the forest itself, you know, comes to life and marches out to battle and wins the battle against the dark forces of the opponent's army. And certainly here the trees didn't come to life, you know, and actually do battle. But the idea is the environment of the forest itself was not an ideal place for a battle. It's not like, you know, generally in the ancient world especially, battles were waged on flat, level places as much as possible, so that, you know, troops could be deployed in specific formations and strategies could be enacted and that the commanders of the army could overlook the battlefield and see what was going on. This is, you're turning armies loose in this forest environment. From what I've read, this is a hilly area. There's rocks and pits in the ground, and there's all kinds of physical challenges in the environment itself. And apparently in the turmoil of battle unfolding, many men, you know, fell and lost their lives in, you know, dealing with rocks, pits, and in Absalom's case, actually being killed by a tree. Now, for Absalom, he's riding along on his mule, probably being chased by David's soldiers as he encounters them, and his mule carries him. And we're meant to understand this, not accidentally, not coincidentally, but the mule carries him right under an oak tree where his head is lodged between branches. And the mule, it's kind of a dramatic description, the mule just keeps galloping. And he's left hanging there, suspended between heaven and earth. And I don't think this is just a minor detail of the story that we should read past. What's going on with Absalom here is that while this is David's story, we're focused on David, you know, Absalom is not an insignificant character. And he's not in a good place. He's had a challenging life. Of course, he had some advantages. He was born to David, king of Israel. He was born the king's son. He was born into a rich and famous and powerful family. He was born, if you remember the early story of Absalom, he was the most handsome man in Israel. He was perfect, without flaw physically. So he had a lot of advantages, but he had some disadvantages in his life story too. No one has a perfect backstory. What were Absalom's disadvantages? Well, he had a rich, famous, and powerful father that loved him dearly, but didn't know how to, or if he did know how, refused to parent him in the way that he should have been parented. He wasn't raised properly. He wasn't given the right kind of fatherly influence. So he was raised with character flaws, number one, that wasn't really his fault. The parenting issue wasn't his fault. Two is he had a tragedy in his close family. His own sister, his dearly loved sister, was raped by his half-brother. And then he had the whole issue of how his father dealt with this or failed to deal with it, refused to deal with it. And then he had the exile to deal with, 2 years exiled from the kingdom. And even in being restored, his father gives him the silent treatment. His father refuses to speak to him for a significant period of time. And then once he's embraced, there's no further description about any real heart-to-heart interaction between David and Absalom. They never resolve their issues. So he's got all these challenges. But is he hanging there between heaven and earth this day in that oak tree? Is he hanging there an innocent man? And the answer is, with all of his advantages and with all of his challenges, he is accountable to the Lord. Not to his father David, ultimately. He's accountable to the Lord. Hanging there between heaven and earth, I see this as an amazing expression of one final mercy from the Lord to Absalom. Think about this. You have betrayed your father, the king. You have symbolically stabbed him in the back and stolen the kingdom from your own father, driven him out into the wilderness, and now you're leading a nation that you have no business leading. And in all of that, you're now in the battle of the day that you thought was going to be your glorious entrance into the fullness of your kingdom. You've been caught with your neck in an oak tree. And your mule is run off out from under you, and you're hanging there, and you can't dislodge yourself. You're stuck, but you're alive. You're conscious. You're aware of what's going on. And there's an interesting story here where one of the soldiers of David sees Absalom hanging from the tree but doesn't do anything to him, goes back to find Joab and informs Joab of what's going on, and then Joab's going to come and kill Absalom. But before he gets there, we have a time delay. from when Absalom was first caught in the tree to the soldier seeing him to the time that Joab arrives at the scene. We don't know how long that is. Could be 5 minutes, could be an hour, but he's hanging there for a period of time. And in that period of time, he has an opportunity. Not an opportunity to dislodge himself. He's stuck. His fate is sealed. But spiritually, he's in a place where, if you ever find, let me just give you a word of advice. You ever find yourself suspended between heaven and earth, hanging from an oak tree, and you're alive, what is that a signal for your heart to do? It's time to repent. It's time to take stock. It's time to evaluate. It's time to consider, why am I in this situation? What am I doing here? What led me to this place? Am I here by accident? Am I here by coincidence? Or am I here by the hand of the Lord? And is the Lord trying to get something through to my heart? Is he after something here? Maybe I should consider the Lord. Certainly we saw in previous chapters that the whole process of Absalom taking over the kingdom from his father, never once is there any mention from Absalom's lips of the Lord or his consideration of the Lord or the Lord's role in him becoming king of Israel. And so his heart is not just far and disconnected from his father. The much more serious issue for Absalom is his heart is far from the Lord, disconnected from the Lord. And the Lord's after something. And the Lord's going to get what he's after one way or the other. And in this case, it's the other. Because Absalom is suspended there. He has the opportunity to repent. But what's tragic about this story is not just that Absalom dies. We all die. We'll all come to an end. It's the circumstances of how he dies and what fails to happen in his heart before he dies. There's not a word that escapes from Absalom's lips. There's no hint in the story of what's going on in his mind and heart. He fails to consider the Lord until his final breath, the last beat of his heart, as the javelins from Joab pierce his heart and the swords from Joab's 10 armor bearers repeatedly pierce him, and he dies. He dies a rebel. He dies a hard-hearted, sad and tragic figure. He dies under the judgment of the Lord. Now there's a deep lesson here for fathers. The lesson is this. David was not a good father. Look where his son ends up. Now, this isn't the first and only son that ends up in this place. For David, this is a bitter pill to swallow, but this is now the third son that David has lost because of the sins of that day with Bathsheba and her husband Uriah the Hittite. The third son. The first son was the baby that was conceived from the sin between him and Bathsheba. The firstborn of Bathsheba, that baby grew ill and died right after birth. That was a tragic thing. David understood it was the consequence of the Lord. In fact, Nathan even identified very clearly to him, the prophet, that this was the hand of the Lord in a consequence for David's sin. But that there would be long-term consequences. The sword would never depart from his house. And so Amnon, the brother of Absalom, the half-brother, the son of David, who had raped his sister Tamar, he was killed. Killed by the hand of Absalom, to be sure, but he was still David's son. David lost his second son, Amnon, and now David loses his third and most loved son of all, Absalom. So what is David learning? There's no escaping the consequences of the Lord. When the Lord proclaims, certain events will occur because I've crossed these lines. Those are going to happen. But there's another lesson for fathers that I think every godly father would be wise to pay attention to, and that is this: if, as a father, we fail to raise our sons in the way they should be raised, And if our sons choose to go down pathways that we know are not right and wise for them to go down, whether we hold them accountable or not, the Lord will hold them accountable. And that's what happens here. David did everything he could to stop this from happening that day. But he couldn't stop it because the Lord ordained it. He ordered Joab directly, do not do this. Treat my son gently for my sake. Not just an order of a commander, but an appeal of a friend to a friend. Please treat him with kid gloves. And what does Joab do? As soon as he hears that Absalom's vulnerable, it takes three javelins. I mean, as if one javelin wouldn't do the job. I mean, how many times do you have to, pierce someone through the heart with a javelin before they die? And he takes three and pierces him through the heart. And then, that's not enough. Joab's in overkill mode. He has his 10 armor bearers, the young men that are his personal bodyguard in battle. He has them surround Absalom with their swords and continually pierce him with swords to just make sure he's dead. And then after his death, there's some significance in how his body is treated. In our culture, we have a failure to understand the importance of the human body and its place and purpose in God's long-range plans for our, not just our personal lives, but in all of history. And we have diminished in our present generation the significance of what happens to people after they die in terms of the disposition of their physical body. But in the ancient world, it was very significant, very important. There's several key stories in the scripture of what happens with the physical body after death and how it's handled. For instance, there's a very famous story about that later is just referenced for us in the book of Jude about what happens with the body of Moses after he dies. There's the story, of course, of Abraham negotiating to purchase an entire field just to acquire the right to bury his wife in a certain special circumstance. And many other stories, of course, leading up to the most famous and important one, the disposition of the body of the Lord Jesus after his death on the cross. But typically, when the king's son dies, you want to take that body that represented his life, and you want to treat that with, like state honors, as we describe it. If the son of the president were to die of the United States, there'd be special arrangements made in that funeral, and the whole nation would pay attention, and there'd be a certain kind of mourning that would take place. What's interesting here is that Joab doesn't just kill Absalom. He takes his body and does what with it? He throws it into a pit, which biblically symbolizes and is connected with continuing judgment. We talk about the pits of hell, and there's reason for that because of the association throughout Scripture with the pit. So his body is thrown into a pit, and then over his body, he has his soldiers pile a large heap of what? Stones. And this is while he was killed with javelins and swords. The imagery here is this is what was done with a person that was killed under judgment, and that we see in Scripture of how rebels in the ancient Israelite culture were dealt with in a public execution of stoning, and their death being their final resting places under a large heap of stones, those stones symbolizing God's judgment upon them. And I don't want us to see here that Joab's in a great place, because he's not. Joab's an interesting and mixed character throughout David's story, sometimes doing what's right and sometimes doing what's wrong and just pursuing his own political purposes. And in this case, there's a mixture also, because Joab's not in a good place motivationally. His perspective is not in a good place because he's disobeying a direct order from his king and his friend. Nevertheless, he is also serving the Lord's purpose, whether he's aware of it and conscious of it or not. as carrying out the Lord's instructions, carrying out the Lord's judgment, carrying out as God's representative, God's execution orders toward Absalom. And even in the burial details, Absalom's final resting place is under a pile of judgment stones. And then the story makes that connection for us, because we could easily read past that detail and miss it. But as the writer describes the historical context of his final resting place, he reminds us that before this day, Absalom, he wasn't king for very long, only a few days. But Absalom had made arrangements, thinking long term for himself, for his name, for his reputation, and for his fame to extend to successive generations. What had Absalom arranged for? He had arranged for a monument to himself. You know how this is, like when we invaded Iraq as a nation a few years ago. You remember that one dramatic scene on the news stations when, you know, rolling into Baghdad, the capital city, we saw the people of the city with ropes pulling down that giant statue. It was a statue of what? Saddam Hussein. Who do you think built that statue? Saddam Hussein. And you know how it is. Rulers, especially this kind of ruler that Absalom represents, you know, they're concerned to exalt themselves. And so he had made arrangements for a monument. And his intention was a monument to his fame and honor for successive generations. And the irony here, and it's very ironic, and it's ironic in a sad way, but a telling way, a spiritually purposeful way, is the Lord made Absalom's final resting place a monument. It just wasn't the monument he had intended. I mean, Absalom had intended. It's a monument of judgment. And apparently, I've never been there, of course, but from the commentaries I have available to me, apparently they're still to this day. You can go and visit in Israel. You can visit the monument to Absalom that remains to this day. And the sad thing here is, and what we're meant to catch from this, is that the Lord is making Absalom an object lesson. He's making him something like, you know, when you pass this way, stop. Think about this man's life. Think about what his life meant. Think about what he missed, failed to understand. Think about the lines that he chose to cross. Think about his relationship to his father. Think about the failures of his father. And think about what the Lord caused to happen in spite of Absalom and in spite of David, in order to teach our hearts something that we cannot afford to miss. So, the story ends with Absalom's death. Hard lessons for anyone that has ears to hear and eyes to see. Absalom had made plans to be the king, and he was the king. He just wasn't the king nearly as long as he thought he was going to be, and his rule didn't end nearly the way he thought it was going to end. And the idea here is that the best laid plans, you know, are not going to be able to outplan or outwit or outstrategize the Lord and his sovereignty and his purpose. And while for short periods of time, evil men may think they're getting away with what they have plotted and planned to accomplish, the Lord's purpose will succeed at the end of the story. And David, of course, receives news of the battle. There's an interesting, you know, extended story of how the news travels to David through these two runners. And there are some important points in there, but really side issues from the story that we're focused on this morning. So the news finally arrives back to the city where David is waiting. This is not the city of Jerusalem, of course. This is the city in the wilderness where David has found refuge. And when the news reaches him, he discerns immediately it's good news. And both of the runners do say to him, your forces have won the battle. But what's the first concern and question out of David's heart and mouth for both runners? He doesn't ask about the disposition of his troops, those who remained loyal to him, those that fought on his behalf, those who won the battle for him. He doesn't ask, how many of my loyal soldiers did I lose in battle today? He asks one question only of both runners. Is it well with my boy? Is Absalom okay? It's almost like this, and it's sad. It's almost like, I don't care if I lost 20,000 of my troops, my loyal soldiers that fought for me. I don't care if all three of my generals died in the battle. I just want to know, did Absalom make it? Did he survive? Of course, Absalom at this point has already been executed by Joab, and his story has come to a tragic end. So when David hears that news, he's overwhelmed. And we see him cry out, and it's a noticeable pattern in his cry. Let's read again the very end of the chapter, verse 33. The king was deeply moved and went up to the chamber over the gate and wept. And as he wept, he said, O my son Absalom, my son Absalom, would I had died instead of you, O Absalom, my son. Five times he cries out, my son. His heart can only see this. No consideration at this key moment of the Lord. Only his own concerns. Is it wrong for a father to so love his son? Yes, it is wrong for a father to so love his son. Why? Because at this moment in David's life, David loves his son more than he loves the Lord. At this moment, he loves his son more than he loves the Lord. Doesn't mean that there's no love for the Lord in his heart at all. And we will see again in David's life, consideration of the Lord, concern for the Lord, walking with the Lord. It doesn't mean that David is turning away from the Lord. It just means that at this moment, he has priorities and the Lord is not his priority. He's overwhelmed by a consuming love for his son, Absalom. A love that's out of proportion. See, the Lord does to every godly father, he gives you a sufficient, true, and deep love for any child that he places in your care as your son or your daughter. He gives you that love. That's his grace. That's his gift. That's his blessing. But that love is never to rise to the level where it outweighs your love for the Lord. Now, Jesus teaches us that the core principle of discipleship, we are to learn how to love the Lord our God with all of our heart, all of our soul, all of our mind, and all of our strength. And the second is like it, but never in front of it. Love our neighbor as we love ourselves. And in this case, the neighbor being his own son. The idea being that David has flipped that order and he has loved Absalom before and above his love for the Lord. He, of course, should have been pained at the news of the death of his son. But that's all he can consider. And that leads us to the next chapter in which we're going to see that Joab is going to return from the battle and rightly rebuke David for being so consumed with only this concern without any consideration or concern for his loyal troops who have won this great battle for him. So, hard lessons, and David has come so far, and he's learned so much. But his discipleship lessons are not over yet. He's an older man now. He should have been wise at this point. He should have been past this. But I can just speak for, as someone who's, now for me, 33 years in the Lord, you know, you would think after 33 years, I've learned all the lessons, right? You know, I've reached the point where You know, all those things are behind me, all those failures, all those character flaws. You know, it just, I never cease to amaze myself at how I can fail at some of the most simple lessons, some of the most, you know, violate some of the most simple principles of walking with the Lord, following Him, doing what's right in His eyes, putting Him before I put myself in certain circumstances. And David is missing this lesson. The Lord is still after this. This is the biggest issue. This is the backstory. This is what the Lord has been after. This was what the Lord was after the day he failed with Bathsheba. This is what the Lord is still after. And David is still struggling to learn this lesson, that the Lord is first and foremost in his life. All right, we'll end with that this morning, and we'll prepare to pick up in 2 Samuel 19 next time.